In our study of the book of Philippians, in chapter 3, we noted that Paul talked about some of the privileges, the position that he occupied within the religion of Judaism under the old law. But sometimes that expression, Pauline privilege, is used in a different sense to talk about marriage and divorce. The Pauline privilege, if you are in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, still, is contained supposedly in verse 15. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 15, where the Apostle Paul wrote to the Corinthians, "But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace." And the Pauline privilege view suggests that Paul, in this passage, has introduced a second, an additional cause for scriptural divorce. That in addition to what Jesus said in Matthew the 19th chapter and in Matthew the 5th chapter, verse 32, that a spouse could be put away and a remarriage could take place if that spouse put away had committed sexual immorality, that Paul is now introducing a second reason, an additional reason, that is called the Pauline privilege. Well, this evening we're going to be talking about that passage among some other things. This is one of our question and answer sermons. And I think I mentioned recently that I was kind of running low on questions, and several of you have provided me with some pretty good questions. So we'll begin to answer those from time to time. For those of you who are not familiar with what we're doing this evening, I'm going to address a mere 10 questions, and they are not necessarily all related to one another. In fact, this evening they're not related at all. We'll just move from one question to another. And the questions that we're going to be looking at this evening are these. How many apostles were there? Now, I've asked on slides for easy questions. And so somebody accommodated me. How many apostles were there? And then, of course, we want to talk a little bit about what's called the Pauline privilege, as I've described it from 1 Corinthians 7, verse 15. And then, if time permits, we'll look at the eunuch's confession. I was kidding David as he was up here putting his song slides up. Some of you who, those of you who lead singing are aware that the software we use will allow you to select specific verses within a song. You don't have to sing all the verses. You can select the first verse and the second, or the second and first and last, and then you can even select the chorus to be sung only once at the end of the song or at the end of each verse. And I was kidding, David said, I bet there are some folks who would like to be able to do that with my outline. If we could just right-click on Alan's outline and go straight from the introduction to the conclusion, we'd get out of here much faster. Well, this evening, I know the slide that takes us to the invitation. So if we get to the third question and our time is gone, I'll save that question for the next sermon and we'll just jump to the invitation at that point. So let's talk about this first question. How many apostles were there? Well, that's easy, right? 12 apostles. Jesus selected 12 apostles. And as we look in the Gospels, all of the Synoptic Gospels record a list of 12 apostles. They're interesting to compare. I didn't put them up there because that's not really our focus this evening, because there are some of the apostles who were known by different names. And when you put the list together, it becomes apparent which apostles had more than one name and what their different names were. But, wait a minute. What about Judas, who betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver and then went out and hanged himself? Acts, the first chapter, tells us that Matthias was one of two men qualified, as Peter enumerated the qualifications to be an apostle there in Acts chapter 1, verses 15 through 26. Matthias was one of the two men, and Peter called upon the Lord to choose the right man by means of a lot, casting of lot. And so Matthias is chosen to replace Judas. Well, that's 13 apostles. if my pulpit math serves. But we're not done yet, because later on, Saul of Tarsus, former persecutor of the church, will end up being an apostle, and he describes himself clearly as an apostle, born in due out of due season in 1 Corinthians the 15th chapter 8 9. He was an apostle selected after the others, the 12, the 13 already. In chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians, in the beginning of the chapters, he discusses the right of a preacher to live of the gospel. He said, "Am I not an apostle?" It was a rhetorical question. He affirms to the Corinthians that he was in fact an apostle and had produced the signs of an apostle. You'll see that in 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter. And then in Romans chapter 1 and verse 1, there's an example that you can multiply in his various epistles where Paul introduces himself as an apostle of Jesus Christ. He describes himself in Romans chapter 11 and verse 13 as the apostle to the Gentiles. So that makes 14 apostles. Well, we're not done yet, because there are other uses of the apostle, the word apostle. Barnabas is described in Acts the 14th chapter by Luke in verses 4 and 14 as an apostle. Of course, he wasn't part of the 12, that group, the 12. When Paul describes in Galatians 1 what he did following his conversion, he indicated that he didn't go up to Jerusalem immediately, but when he went up to Jerusalem, he didn't confer with any of the apostles except James, the Lord's brother, he says. Now, I'm not convinced necessarily that Paul intended to say that James was an apostle, but the text kind of reads that way. You could understand it that way, certainly. Jesus is an apostle. Someone says, wait a minute. Jesus called the apostles. He's the one who sent out the 12 initially, and then later on, of course, appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus. How could Jesus be called an apostle when, in fact, he was the one who called others to be apostles? Well, I've been toying with you, because we can clear this up by simply observing that the word apostle is the translation, the English translation, of a Greek word that just literally means a messenger. And we can even add some additional men to the roster of messengers or apostles, and we'll do that in just a moment. Jesus is called an apostle because he was sent by the Father, as he himself notes in John chapter 5, John chapter 17, verse 3, sent by the Father to this earth. And so the Hebrew writer says, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession. That's an interesting description, incidentally, because it views Jesus from two different directions. An apostle suggests that he was sent by the Father to this earth, but a high priest was one who mediated between man and God, specifically offering gifts on behalf of men to God. And so Jesus serves as the conduit, if you please, for both from the Father and from man to the Father. There are others, of course, who are described by this same Greek word, besides the ones we've already noted, for we've talked about Barnabas. Paul mentions in 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 23, two brothers. He doesn't name them, but he describes them as apostles. Now, if you look in your version, your Bible, it probably doesn't translate apostles. It translates messengers, but it's the same word that's translated apostle in other places. And so sometimes the word apostle seems to be used in a rather clinical or technical sense, and other times it's used just in the general sense to talk about someone who is a minister, or I should say a messenger. We've just been studying Philippians, and Epaphroditus is also described as a messenger. He was the messenger of the Philippians to Paul, carrying their gift to Paul in prison. And in Philippians 2 and verse 25, the same word that's translated apostle elsewhere is used to describe him, although it's translated messenger. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 6, it appears as Paul writes to the Thessalonians about the time that he and his companions Silas and Timothy were at Thessalonica, he describes all of them, it appears, as apostles. Was Paul including Silas and Timothy as apostles? Because if he was, we now have a grand total of 22 apostles. You didn't think the answer was this complicated, did you? Well, let me give my answer. How many apostles were there? The original apostles, of course, selected by Jesus, are called the 12. And the Gospels designate them as the 12. They were a select group among a number of disciples who in some cases could have met the same qualifications as the apostles, the initial 12. Matthias later on would meet those qualifications. I want you to note especially, however, in Acts, the first chapter, and I didn't mention this earlier because I wanted to talk about it at this point. Look, if you will, in the account of Acts chapter 1 in which Matthias is chosen to replace Judas. When Peter talks to the disciples about what had happened with Judas, Judas had gone out and hanged himself. He was overcome by remorse, by grief, and he killed himself, and so there were only 11 apostles. And so Peter, in verse 20 of Acts 1, says, "For it is written in the book of Psalms, may his camp become desolate, and let there be no one to dwell in it." And so he applies that, to Judas, but now notice the rest of the verse. And he quotes from Psalm 108 or 109, verse 8, "And let another take his office." Have you ever wondered why they selected another apostle? Could they have gotten by with 11? Or could Paul have just simply been the 12th apostle later on, once the Lord appeared to him on the road to Damascus? Peter says, the text of Psalm 109 is prophetic. So when Judas exits the group of apostles by reason of death, Peter says, the scripture says, let another take his place. And so they selected another. They selected Matthias. So one of the men who have accompanied us during all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning from the baptism of John until the day when he was taken up from us, one of these men must become with us a witness to his resurrection. Part of the reason I wanted to answer this question, I think it's a fairly simple question, to be honest with you, but part of the reason I wanted to answer it is that sometimes we make the argument when we're talking to people who would affirm that there are modern day apostles, that nobody today can meet the requirements of Acts chapter 1. That is certainly true. There's nobody alive today who followed along with Jesus. I understand that. But would we argue that the Apostle Paul was not really an apostle because he didn't fit that requirement either? Saul of Tarsus did not, as Peter says, accompany Jesus as a witness from the baptism of John until the time of Jesus' ascension. And yet the scriptures are very clear that he was an apostle, and Paul himself argues that he wasn't one whit behind the chiefest of the apostles. So why is he an apostle if he doesn't meet the qualifications of Acts chapter 1? Could it be that we have used an argument that really isn't a strong argument to argue against modern day apostles? I would suggest to you that those qualifications here are designed to select just the 12, but not necessarily other apostles, because Paul doesn't fit in this group, and yet he's clearly an apostle. Now, lest anybody think that I'm waffling, I don't believe there are modern-day apostles, living apostles. But sometimes we use arguments that, when they are subjected to some scrutiny, are not really good arguments. They're not convincing arguments. And so, in the Bible drill class, we have an A question. How many apostles did Jesus call? That's significant. Because there are men who are described as messengers, but Jesus didn't call them to be part of this group of the 12. Jesus personally called 13. He called the original 12, obviously, during his public ministry here on earth. And then, of course, he appeared to Paul. Paul was specifically called by the Lord as well. Matthias was selected, but indirectly by Jesus, by means of lot. And others are described as apostles, but not specifically called by Jesus. So sometimes asking the question the right way is very important. You have to get it specific enough in order to make the answer fit. So in the next Bible drill class, when I ask the A question, how many apostles are there? And some youngster chips up and says, 22. I'm taking that answer. Okay? Because there are at least that many who are described in a general way as being messengers. And that's what an apostle was. The 12 were a special group of messengers. Now, the next question has to do with what we talked about as the Pauline privilege. This is the question. Notice the quotation marks. This is exactly how I received it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 10 through 16, there's discussion about letting your unbelieving spouse depart. It says, and there's a quotation there, a brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. Verse 15 is the one that's being quoted. What does this mean considering grounds for divorce? We need to back up a little bit, I think, and talk about the general or the greater context of 1 Corinthians 7. There seems to have been some confusion at Corinth on the subject of marriage and perhaps also on the subject of divorce as well. There's indication in chapter 7 in the very first verse, as Paul begins this discussion, that the Corinthians had possibly sent some questions, had clearly sent some questions to Paul, and it may be that some of the Corinthians had doubts about whether marriage was in fact a holy relationship or whether celibacy was not evil, or whether celibacy was even superior to the marital relationship. And so we begin the context by saying that Paul's answering questions that have been posed to him by the Corinthians. And what he does in the beginning of the chapter is he affirms the legitimacy of both celibacy and marriage. Paul makes some statements in the chapter that need to be understood in their historical context. Verse 26 talks about a present distress. We don't know exactly what that was. It may have been persecution. But at any rate, Paul says that it was his judgment, in view of these historical circumstances, that for the time being, that people not enter into a marital relationship. And he explains why. Persecution can cause for some real stress when you are wanting to protect your mate, but you need to be loyal, faithful to Jesus Christ. But he also makes the observation that if an individual marries, he or she has not sinned, that both celibacy, that is not marrying, and marrying are both legitimate. And he notes in the early part of chapter 7 the marital responsibilities, that is of a sexual nature, and the danger of not fulfilling those responsibilities, that an individual spouse is left open to temptation by Satan if marital responsibilities are not fulfilled. Now, Paul, I think a little later on in verses 10 and 11, sets out the fundamental principle for all married people. And so we're going to read these verses again. Appreciated the reading that was done by Aaron. But so that we can zero in on some of these things, let's reread verses 10 and 11. Paul says, "To the married, I give this charge, not I," he says, "but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does," he says, "she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife." Now, I believe that in verse 10, when Paul says, "not I, but the Lord," he's saying, I'm basically repeating what the Lord said. But then as he moves into verses 12 and following, 12 through 16, Paul is going to begin dealing with some special situations or circumstances that didn't exist when Jesus made his comments, as recorded in the Gospels, about marriage and divorce. There weren't any Christians and non-Christians when Jesus made his comments about when an individual could put away a spouse without sin and remarry. So Paul then begins to talk about these special circumstances. And so in verse 12 he says, "To the rest I say, I not the Lord." Paul's not saying the Lord's not with me on this. I'm venturing out on my own here, and he wouldn't necessarily agree. Paul's just saying, I'm not repeating what the Lord taught. I'm expanding on what he said in these special circumstances. Verse 12 again. To the rest I say, I not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. And so Paul talks about a mixed marriage. I've got mixed marriages up here, and I want to define that as a religiously mixed marriage. You've got a believer and an unbeliever. And Paul says that as long as the unbeliever is content to dwell with the believer, then there's no reason to separate. There's no reason to divorce. Verse 13, if any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. So he just flips the same principle. And then in verse 14, he affirms the legitimacy of marriage between a Christian and an unbeliever. Now, we could talk a little bit about whether a Christian sins when they marry an unbeliever. That's not our point this evening. But I think we ought to think about the implications of Paul saying that if you've got an unbeliever and a believer and they are married, if they're content, if the unbeliever is content to stay with the believer, then they need to stay in that relationship. If that relationship is inherently sinful, then why is Paul telling the believer to stay in a relationship that's inherently sinful? Now, having said all that, I wouldn't recommend that you marry an unbeliever. And that's not because I don't like anybody who's not a Christian. It is that they are operating on different principles with different priorities, different allegiances and loyalties than the Christian is. And so it's like playing a Monopoly game with somebody who's got different rules. Back when I was growing up, of course, we didn't have video games and all that, so Cheryl and Vicky and I, and a little later on, Andrew, would play board games. I cannot tell you how many times the game broke up. It was almost like a saloon brawl, because Vicky and Andrew would sometimes play the game by themselves, and they would institute new rules. Only we didn't find out about those rules until we were well into the game. And then all of a sudden someone says, oh yeah, you can do that. What do you mean you can do that? You can't do that. And the game would eventually just break up, because you can't play a game like that unless you're playing by the same rules. And marriage is in a very complicated relationship. It's not a game. But if two people, spouses, are not working with the same or by the same principles, then most of the time there are going to be some problems. There are going to be some concessions that are going to have to be made. And the question is, who will make those concessions? But in verse 14, I said I wasn't going to talk about that. I went ahead and did it anyway. Paul essentially says that these marriages, between these religiously mixed marriages, they're okay as long as the unbeliever is willing to live with the believer. But then he talks about another case in verses 15 and 17, another set of circumstances. It's a religiously mixed marriage in which the unbeliever is not content to dwell together. Let's read verses 15 and 16 together. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? And the argument behind the Pauline privilege that is supposed to exist is that in this passage in verse 15, Paul is now offering a second cause for scriptural divorce. Well, the passage we're talking about, obviously, is verse 15. In the ESV, the text reads, is not enslaved, for not under bondage. It's the same idea. There's no significant difference there. It's affirmed that that expression, not enslaved, means that when the unbeliever departs or separates, and the intimation is that there's a divorce that takes place, that the one divorced is free to remarry. They're free from the marriage bond. They're not under bondage anymore. That's the argument that is made. The issue, of course, is the legitimacy of remarriage, not divorce. I suppose I should have talked about that this morning when we were talking about wives and their responsibilities in the marital relationship. We should have talked about the fact that in our country, in our culture, you cannot stop your mate from divorcing you if they really want to. You can slow down the process, you can put the brakes on it if you choose, but ultimately it's going to happen. And it's the culture, it's the judicial system of our land. But what that means is that you can't determine by yourself whether you're going to stay in a relationship. It takes two to decide that they're going to stay in that relationship. I may be totally committed to our marriage, and Debbie decides that she's found a better looking guy. I don't know what she's thinking. But she finds a better looking guy that she thinks is better looking, and so she decides to divorce me, and I can't stop her. But if she doesn't divorce me for sexual immorality, as Jesus says in Matthew 19:9, is a legitimate cause for divorce, then I can't remarry and neither can she. And so in a sense, I have to live with not just my commitment to stay in the marriage, I have to live with her decision as well. That really means pick your spouse carefully. And that's another good reason why you don't want to marry an unbeliever who says, you know what? You burn the biscuits and your history, I'll go marry somebody else who can cook better. And so we need to be careful about that. But the issue here is not the divorce, because we can't stop that necessarily, even as believers. The issue is whether we could remarry. If I'm married to an unbeliever and the unbeliever divorces me, do I have the right then to remarry? That's the point. And the Pauline privilege theory says that I do have the right to remarry because I was deserted by my spouse. Let me make some preliminary observations about this particular theory. First of all, if this desertion by the unbeliever is in fact a second exception in addition to sexual immorality, it's a conditional one. It is conditional. It is in the case of a religiously mixed marriage. If you've got two Christians who are married, two believers who are married to one another, and one of them just decides they're going to go bonkers and go divorce, that's not what's being spoken of here. This context is talking about a religiously mixed marriage. Secondly, it has to be a case where the unbeliever is the one who does the divorcing. So you've got a religiously mixed marriage, believer and unbeliever, and the believer says, you know what? I'm tired of living with this guy, and so I'm going to divorce him. And 1 Corinthians 7:15 says, I can do that, and I can remarry. I'm not under bondage any longer. Well, that's not what the text says. It has to be a case of where the unbeliever departs or divorces, not the believer. The believer needs to be willing to live with the unbeliever. That's what Paul said in verses 12 and 13. You hear me? The believer needs to be willing to live with the unbeliever, according to verses 12 and 13. If verse 15, in that phrase, not under bondage, grants a release from the marriage bond, then interestingly enough, Paul is allowing in verse 15 what he prohibited in verses 10 and 11. Verses 10 and 11, he said, if you're married, don't seek a divorce. And he even in verse 11 suggests that if a woman ends up divorcing, then she needs to not go ahead and compound her sin by remarrying somebody else. So verse 15, it would seem strange offer an additional cause for divorce when Paul just got done saying in verses 10 and 11 that that's not what married people should do. We need to talk a little bit about this phrase, is not enslaved or not under bondage. And so let's refresh the verse here. There is a word in the New Testament that is, in its noun form, means a slave. We talked a little bit about this word as we were discussing the epistle to Philemon, epistle from Paul. It's the word doulos. And it is used many, many times in the New Testament. I think someone has estimated about 165 plus times in the New Testament. It means, in its verb form, this is the verb form here, it means to enslave someone or to cause to be like a slave, to bring someone into bondage or to make subject to oneself. If you're going to use this verb, that's the kind of meaning that it has. Now listen to me carefully. You can go through every passage that talks about the bond of marriage in the New Testament, and this word is never used to talk about the yoke or the bond of marriage unless 1 Corinthians 7:15 is the one time. Let that sink in. We've got lots of other passages that talk about being loosed or being bound. In fact, some of them are in 1 Corinthians 7, chapter 7 here, a little bit earlier or a little bit later in the text. But nowhere in the New Testament is this particular word used to talk about the marriage bond. There's another word that is repeatedly used in the context of marriage to talk about this bond, this yoke that is described as the marital relationship. It's the word deo. It's a different Greek word. That phrase is translated from this word, not that word. Now someone says, well, that seems kind of technical. Well, it may be. But we're forced to dig deeper because of these theories that are attempting to introduce things that are not clearly introduced in the Word. Is the believer free from the marriage bond? If the unbeliever divorces the believer and separates in that sense, is the believer then free and able to remarry as though this were a second exception? Well, there's another fact that you need to know about this verb right here. In this particular verse, it is in the perfect tense. Now that doesn't mean a whole lot until you recognize the implication of that tense in the Greek language. In our English language, the perfect tense just talks about something that's happened in the past. In the Greek language, tense often refers not simply to time, but kind of action, whether it's a continuing action or a point action, in addition to time. And the perfect tense is a complicated tense because it talks about action that was completed in the past with present or continuing results. That's why even though this is a perfect verb, perfect in the sense of that's its tense, it's translated by the present tense. Is, not was, but is not enslaved. Because in our English language, we don't have a tense that corresponds exactly to the Greek perfect tense. And so translators, and they do, you find it in every version. It's not, it doesn't have to do with the ESV or the New King James Version. Translators have to choose which aspect of that verb tense they're going to emphasize, whether it's going to be the past action that's completed or whether it's going to be the continued results. And that's why you'll find a perfect tense that sometimes translated by a past tense in the English, and sometimes it's translated by the present tense in the English. How many of you would like for me to skip to the invitation slide right now? Okay, you're a very patient bunch. I appreciate that. So, what does that mean for us? What's the big deal about that? Well, the implication of this verse, this verb, he says, in such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. That's the present situation. But the point is, he wasn't enslaved in the past. And he continues to not be enslaved. Now, think about that. If this word is referring to the marriage bond, the believer and the unbeliever, were they bound in the past? Well, yes, they were married. Paul said in verse 14 that marriage is a legitimate relationship. So they were bound in the past. But this verb says they were not bound in the past and they continue to not be bound. That's the implication of the perfect tense. Well, that doesn't fit very well with what else we know about their relationship. Is this really a good description of this marriage? The unbeliever and the believer never really joined in marriage? No, that's not the point. Well, if it doesn't mean that the marriage bond is broken, what does not enslaved mean? Well, I believe what it means is that the Christian is not obligated to try to preserve the marriage. In fact, Paul says, for how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? So here's a believer, the wife, and she is struggling to keep this marriage together. And so she makes whatever concession she needs to in order to keep the unbeliever in the house, in the marriage. He says, if you keep going to services, you keep giving of your income, you keep doing all these things that Christians do, I'm out of here, I'm leaving. And Paul says, let him go. Let him go. Now, he divorces the believer. Does that mean the believer now is free to remarry? No, that's not what Paul says. Paul just says, we're not enslaved. I don't have to try to maintain that marriage or preserve that marriage at whatever cost. Because, he says, how do you know that you'll save that individual, the husband or the wife, depending on who it is that's doing the leaving, the unbeliever, who's doing the leaving? What's my answer? This is the slide we've been waiting for. 1 Corinthians 7:15 is not another cause for scriptural divorce. Jesus gave the one cause in Matthew 19 and verse 9. The word that's translated not enslaved is not the word that's used for the marriage bond in other passages. Never, unless this is the only place. The Greek tense of the verse suggests that the believer is not under bondage, nor has been in the past. But that doesn't describe the situation of the marriage bond. It's talking about a different bondage or enslavement. I like the word enslavement because we don't understand marriage to be a form of slavery. I wonder if that's a good place to stop. I've got one more question. It has to do with the eunuch's confession of Christ in Acts chapter 8, verse 37. But I'm going to, as the Senate did, exercise the nuclear option. And we're going to go to the invitation. If we had been able to talk about the eunuch's confession, we would have been able to suggest that the core of our faith is our trust in this fact. That is that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And that's the confession that we ask people to make when they obey the gospel. You know what's interesting to me? In the very beginning, when God put Adam and Eve in the garden, He gave them a law. And the sin that Eve committed and then Adam committed with her in eating this forbidden fruit, whatever it was that she believed a lie that Satan told her. God said, you'll die? No, you'll not die. God knows that you'll be like Him. The implication is He doesn't want you to be that way. Isn't it ironic that the path to our freedom from sin lies in us believing the truth about Jesus Christ? That He is, as Paul says in Romans 10, verses 9 and 10, Lord, and that He was raised from the dead. Confirmation, incidentally, Romans 1 and verse 4, that He is the Son of God. If you believe that with all your heart, as Philip said to the Ethiopian eunuch, there's no reason why you can't obey the gospel this evening. You could make that confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and having repented of your sins, you can be baptized, immersed in water, buried in baptism, into the death of Jesus Christ, into your death to sin for the remission of sins. And that's exactly what we want to encourage you to do. If you've not done that, why not tonight? Let's stand and sing.